Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, an original in-depth investigative report, a white paper, Sugar, Killing Us Sweetly. This paper will be published online with all of its scientific references. Why am I doing this report? Because for decades we've been led to believe that sugar's not a problem. If anything, it enhances the flavor of items and improves our overall appreciation for a diet. But a careful and honest and objective look at the actual independent peer-reviewed literature shows just the opposite. In September of 2013, a bombshell report was produced by the major largest Swiss bank at their research institute, and it brought into sharp focus the staggering health consequences of sugar on the health of Americans. The group revealed that approximately, quote, 30 to 40% of healthcare expenditures in the United States go to help address issues that are closely tied to the excess consumption of sugar, end quote. The figure suggests that our national addiction to sugar runs us an incredible $1 trillion in healthcare cost each year. The Swiss report highlighted several health conditions, including coronary heart disease, type 2 diabetes, metabolic syndrome, which numerous studies have linked to excessive sugar intake. Just a year earlier, in 2012, a report by Dr. Sanjay Gupta, appearing on 60 Minutes, featured the work of a Dr. Robin Lustig, an endocrinologist from California who gained national attention after a lecture he gave entitled Sugar, the Bitter Truth, went viral in 2009. Dr. Lustig's research has investigated the connections between sugar consumption and the poor health of the American people. He's published 12 articles in peer-reviewed journals identifying sugar as a major factor in the epidemic of degenerative diseases that now affects this country. The data compiled by Dr. Lustig clearly show how excessive sugar consumption plays a key role in the development of many types of cancer, obesity, type 2 diabetes, hypertension, and heart disease. His research has led him to conclude that 75% of all diseases in America today are brought on by the American lifestyle and are entirely preventable. Using this data, we have to understand that we're dealing in two worlds. One is the so-called official world that only acknowledges that something is wrong when it has to. But then there's the real world of real independent science that when it finds something's wrong, it reports it. That doesn't mean that it goes from its medical journal or scientific publication into the mainstream media and hence into our consciousness. If that were the case long ago, probably 90% of the things we eat and drink would have been stopped. So until the airing of this program, no one in the official world acknowledged anything was wrong with sugar. But for those who still may be cynical, let me give you the hard science behind it. It doesn't take much time, but it's essential that this audience understands that we have science on our side, those of us who are challenging the health consequences of the American diet, especially sugar. Here are the newest publications. These are all recent. And I'll just give you the title of the article. I will not give you the scientist. I'll give you the publication and the title of the article. All of this is completely laid out in the article itself and can be used by any lawyer in class action lawsuits, individuals, or just to educate yourself. Consumption of sugar-sweetened drinks linked to heart disease. Circulation, that's the peer-reviewed journal. How fructose causes obesity and diabetes, proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Corn syrup and obesity, American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. Soda and sugary beverages linked to diabetes and metabolic syndrome, diabetes care. Fructose intake connected with an increased risk of cardiovascular illness and diabetes in teenagers, Journal of Nutrition. Fructose consumption increases the risk of heart disease, the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. Negative impact of sugar drinks on children, Pediatric Annuals. Sugar and high blood pressure, the expert review of cardiovascular therapy. Sugar consumption associated with fatty liver disease and diabetes. Nature reviews of gastroenterology and hepatology. Fructose, metabolic, and societal parallels of ethanol. And that was in Circulation. Princeton University study shows high fructose corn syrup promotes weight gain. Pharmacology, biochemistry, and behavior. Rats fed high fructose corn syrup exhibit impaired brain function. Hippocampus. High fructose corn syrup intake link with mineral imbalance and osteoporosis. Nutrition reviews. And finally, diet of sugar and fructose impairs brain function, the Journal of Physiology. Mind you, these are all mainstream, highly respected, peer-reviewed journals, independent research. None of it was funded by the sugar industry. Now, that's only a sampling. I have 100 more, and those are listed at the end of the article. With the rapid spread of information in today's internet age, more and more health-conscious consumers and watchdog groups are calling attention to the many studies demonstrating sugar's harmful effects. But many of us in the natural health community have been alarming the public for decades. In point of fact, I've been writing about the hazards of sugar extensively in books and articles. My first major article was in 1971, a whole major section called Sweet Suicide, and I listed what was wrong at that time. In 2002, my documentary Seven Steps to Perfect Health premiered on PBS stations, including WETA in Washington, D.C. Now, as part of the PBS program, I poured sugar out of a bag which equaled the number of teaspoons the average American teenager consumes in a given day. The quantity was verified by my general counsel, Mr. David Slater, who had measured the number of teaspoons earlier in the day on a scale and then put it back in the bag. If anything, my demonstration understated the true amount of sugar that a teenager consumes each day. The program was very well received, and the program director informed me that it was so successful that it had set a record for a non-primetime program and that he intended to replay it probably 8 to 9 times during the drive. However, by the end of the evening, I was informed by him that he was sorry he had bad news. Not only would the program not air again, but I would not be invited back to the station again. Now, this is after I'd presented 5 medically vetted original programs over the years, some of which set station records, on that station. The program director explained sadly to me, and he was very disappointed he had to say this, that the information I presented on the dangers of sugar had run smack up against the president of the station's local board, Sharon Rockefeller. I was told that Mrs. Rockefeller had received a phone call from the sugar lobby in representing all the sugar soft drink makers in America and the confection makers, the candy bar makers, and that the decision had been made to pull the program by her. I was informed that my statements regarding sugar's damaging health effects were deemed inaccurate. As it turned out, Miss Rockefeller at that time was also sitting on the board of the Pepsi-Cola Company, one of the largest users of sugar in America. And my statements were completely accurate. But that was not my first experience of dealing with the politics of sugar, which was also the politics of PBS. And that's true of every station, every PBS station. You run up against anything that in any way is financially challenging or challenges the reputation or ideology of a top person on the local PBS station board, watch how quickly you're disinvited, irrespective of what you've done for the station or how accurate your information. Power wins at PBS. In response, I wrote a meticulous letter fully documenting everything that was right about the information challenging sugar to the sugar industry, to every member of the Washington, D.C. WETA station board, and to Sharon Rockefeller personally. I contested their suppression of my program and their claim that sugar was unrelated to American health epidemics. I asked them to debate me. I ask anyone to debate me. I've done 500 debates. I have no problem debating, and I always come prepared. I had hoped that she or a member of the National Sugar Board would come forward, but I guess they had learned a lesson from 30 years before when they sent their best and brightest out to debate on sugar, on meat, on milk, on pesticides, did a whole series of national debates. It did not go well for them. But instead, they didn't need to debate. They had the power to say no. That was 10 years ago. When we realize how many people since that time have developed diabetes, cardiovascular disease, cancer, many other illnesses after consuming these quantities of sugar, then should we not hold the major media, particularly and specifically all members of that board and Sharon Rockefeller and the people at the Sugar Institute and Dr. Gupta and 60 Minutes morally responsible for having so much scientifically verifiable information on the dangers of sugar consumption, and yet all of them choosing to accept the official statements from official medical groups and official government agencies and trade groups and lobbying groups and spokespersons and scientists for hire, and in effect accepting industry-generated propaganda instead of seeking the truth. If we can find the truth with our limited resources, what possible excuse does Dr. Gupta and 60 Minutes and other respected physicians with unlimited resources have? Why has it taken 40 years since I first wrote about the dangers of sugar for them to finally discover this truth? And how many tens of millions of our children and adults have suffered with diabetes, obesity, heart disease, cancer during these decades, all because of the arrogance, the hubris, and complicity of the medical, industrial, and media complex? A deeper look at the politics of sugar is then necessary. We have to look at the sugar industry, and that reveals huge sums being doled out by the government to prop up sugar companies. In a recent article in the Wall Street Journal, writer Alexandra Wexler explains that American taxpayers are currently responsible for shelling out $280 million to cover the cost of loans from the USDA, which sugar producers are when they're unable to pay back, given the undeniable evidence demonstrating the toxicity of sugar and its enormous toll on the well-being of Americans. Why is it that our health agencies and elected officials are not calling for a much-needed overhaul of existing policy, which, in fact, offer generous supports to the domestic sugar industry? Where is the outrage over bailing out the purveyors of what is likely the most dangerous staple in the American diet? For our answers, let us now follow the money trail. In May of 2013, members of the U.S. Senate voted 54-44 against an amendment to the Farm Bill introduced by Senator Gene Shahin of New Hampshire that would have significantly curtailed federal lending to sugar processors. In an insightful analysis of the vote, Alan Farrago of Counterpunch.org points out that lawmakers opposing the measure were significantly more likely to either represent states in which sugar is grown or to count the sugar industry among their best campaign donors. Though the reform was voted down by senators on both sides of the aisle, listen carefully, Democrats were apparently even more beholden to the sugar interest than their Republican counterparts. Farrago writes, quote, "In the final tally, Democrats opposed sugar reform by 55-40%. U.S. senators from states identified as healthy states But with sugar constituencies like Minnesota, Vermont, Colorado, North Dakota, and Hawaii all voted against doing any reform. They wanted the sugar industry to win. The website opensecrets.org points out that the second highest recipient of campaign cash from sugar interest was Al Franken. Does he call himself a progressive? He can't spell progressive. And he is another corporate Democrat. Franken, in 2013, received tens of thousands of dollars. Quote, sugar is the only industry in the entire agribusiness sector that has consistently supported Democratic causes during the past two decades, end quote. The fact is that the authorities we look upon as official are almost always compromised by lobbyists inside the Beltway, while the mainstream media, enthralled to its advertisers, is still unwilling to report the whole truth about sugar. In order to raise public awareness about this critical issue, I'm providing an in-depth examination of sugar as both a toxic food and as a thoroughly corrupt extension of big business. Let me now share with you the most recent research. In his latest published study, Dr. Lustig and his colleagues unearthed a strong relationship between the incidence of diabetes and sugar availability in populations around the world. Published in the peer-reviewed online journal PLOS ONE, the study showed that those places in which sugar was most available had a greater incidence of type 2 diabetes. Examining the data from 175 countries over the past 10 years, the authors investigated whether the availability of other food groups, including oils, meats, cereals, and fibers, as well as socioeconomic factors such as income, urbanization, and aging, were related to diabetes prevalence. But they only found statistically significant evidence of a sugar's diabetes link. In a piece for the New York Times, columnist Mark Bittman offered his perspective on Dr. Lustig's latest research. Quote, this is good or bad as it gets, the closest thing to causation and a smoking gun that we'll see. To prove scientific causality, you'd have to do a completely controlled diet of thousands of people for decades. It's as technically impossible as proving climate change or football-related head injuries, or, for that matter, tobacco caused cancers. And just as tobacco companies fought, ignored, lied, and obfuscated in the 60s and indeed through the 90s, the pushers of sugar will do the same now. End quote. In an article published February 2012 in the journal Nature, which is considered the most important scientific journal in the world, quote, regulating sugar will not be easy. We recognize that societal intervention to reduce the supply and demand for sugar faces an uphill political battle against a powerful sugar lobby and will require active engagement from all stakeholders. Still, the food industry knows that it has a problem. With enough clamor for change, these shifts in policy become possible. Take, for instance, bans on smoking in public places and the use of designated drivers, not to mention airbags in cars and condom dispensers in public bathrooms. These simple measures, which have all been on the battleground of American politics, are now taken for granted as essential tools for our public health and well-being. It's time to turn our attention to sugar. End quote. So when the world's most important, prestigious, and respected publication has a statement by a group of scientists who have worked on sugar to allow that, then there is no excuse for anyone in the scientific or medical, nursing or pharmaceutical, policymaking, U.S. Public Health Service, FDA, USDA, nowhere can you say now, we didn't know. Then you are utterly incompetent and shouldn't be in any position. I forgot, you're a bureaucrat, technocrat. Of course, you're exactly where we want our most incompetent. The connection between America's epidemic of chronic diseases and sugar grows clearer every day. A recent study by nutritional biologist Kimber Stanhope of the University of California, Davis, associated higher intake of high fructose corn syrup with higher levels of the bad LDL cholesterol, as well as an increased risk of cardiovascular disease. In the study, test subjects were required to replace 25% of their caloric intake with sugary drinks. The study offered further proof that all calories are not created equally, and that those consuming calories from straight sugar are going to end up with artery clogging and actually promoting weight gain. Stanhope's findings corroborate the results of another study in the American Heart Association journal Circulation that was published in March 2012. The study found that men who drank one 12-ounce beverage sweetened with sugar every day were 20% more likely to develop cardiovascular disease than men who did not consume any sugary drinks. An additional study recently published in the Journal of the American Society of Nephrology linked the intake of excess quantities of fructose with cardiovascular illness, diabetes, chronic kidney disease, as well as metabolic syndrome. The damaging effects of sugar on cognitive health have been the subject of many recent studies. In September 2012, scientists at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA uncovered that rats that were fed a diet high in fructose performed poorly in tests using mazes, which were designed to assess memory and learning when compared to the control group. In a 2012 article entitled "Food for Thought, Eat Your Way to Dementia," researchers at Brown University discussed their findings that a diet high in sugary foods disrupts insulin levels and may trigger the buildup of toxic amyloid proteins. Those are the proteins directly implicated in the progression of dementia or Alzheimer's in the brain. Now, these conclusions reinforced by the results of a Mayo Clinic study released in October of 2012, which showed that seniors who consumed a diet high in sugars and carbohydrates had a significantly greater risk of developing mild cognitive impairment and dementia when compared to seniors whose diet contained more fat and protein. I want to take another look at the New York Times. I want to scrutinize an article. The results of these studies effectively disprove some of the claims made in the New York Times article of April 13, 2011. In the article, Gary Taubes appears to ignore volumes of scientific literature incriminating sugar as a serious health hazard, stating that, quote, "Despite the steady accumulation of research, the evidence can still be criticized as falling far short of conclusive," end quote. I would like for the heads of the New York Times, their journalistic oversight group, to examine his article again, and then to review this article and see what it is that he could have put in there had he either done the research that we have done, or if he did, why didn't he not come up with a different finding? And I would like this audience to ask the New York Times today, if you would please, to examine this specific article. Taubes continues to disregard the indisputable evidence behind sugar's toxicity and offers us the delusional and, in my opinion, dangerous notion that it will be a long time before we have any real proof, one way or the other. Quote, "In simpler language, how much of this stuff do we have to eat or drink for how long before it does us to what it does laboratory rats? And is that any amount more than we'd already consumed? Unfortunately, we're unlikely to learn anything conclusive in the near future," end quote. Not the case. I believe that if you're going to be a scholar, hold yourself out as a scholar, then why don't you look at all the data that other scholars have looked at and then argue the issue why you shouldn't come up to similar conclusions of how dangerous sugar is instead of equivocating? That's what I'm asking. Because it's clear from the peer-reviewed literature that we don't have to guess anymore. I would hate to think what argument you would take then if this is your take on sugar, when we have so many articles, what your take would have been on smoking, would you still be saying, well, we don't have the absolute 100% conclusion that a given person smoking a given amount of cigarettes will develop a lung cancer? We can't say that this moment. So what would be your advice? To continue smoking until that absolute study was done? No. No. That should not be what we do. But let me give specifics of why sugar harms your body. When we think of sugar, we often think about the refined white sugar bought in paper packages or cube for tea. If we're worried about too much sugar, maybe we'll check the nutritional information on the backs of processed sweets before we make a purchase. But really, sugar is often underestimated because it's incredibly predominant in many of the foods we eat. The American Heart Association and the USDA share this broader definition of sugar and the amount of sugar we consume each day. In an American Heart Association statement to healthcare professionals, the group provided a broad definition of what sugar constitutes. Quote, there are many sometimes confusing terms used in the literature. Simple carbohydrate, sugar, refers to mono and diglyceride. Complex carbohydrates refers to polysaccharides such as starch. Common disaccharides are sucrose, sucrose plus fructose, found in sugar cane, sugar beets, honey, corn syrup, lactose, found in milk products, and maltose, found from malt. The most common naturally occurring monosaccharide is fructose, found in fruits and vegetables. The term dextrose is used to refer to glucose. So, the latest statistics tell us that the average American consumes 130 pounds of sugar each year, or more than one-third of a pound every day. The average amount of sugar consumed by Americans today is shockingly excessive. As we'll see, the sugar excess contributes to the modern epidemics of obesity, diabetes, heart disease, even cancer. Refined sugar only really became a major part of the human diet in the last 100 years. As reported by the authors of Sugar Busters, refined sugar has only been around during a mere blink in time in our digestive evolution. It's quite logical that we should have added sugar, refined, to the priority list of things that are or may be hazardous to our health. When you see the increase in disease caused by our huge consumption of refined sugar and certain other carbohydrates, sugar just may be the number one culprit in lowering the quality of life and in causing premature death. There's certainly enough evidence to bring that conclusion to our forefront. But let's take a historical look. This is the historical deception. This is how so many people, including dietitians, nutritionists, medical doctors, nurses, were all lied to. This is the big lie. These are the people who intentionally and with malice aforethought distorted the truth. As far back as 1942, the American Medical Association stated it would be in the interest of the public to limit the consumption of sugar in any form when it is not combined with significant proportions of foods high in nutritional quality. Lately, however, the AMA and other medical organizations have been largely silent about sugar consumption. A 1998 report from the CPI found that soft drinks account for 27% of America's beverage consumption. This is accompanied by a low intake of calcium, magnesium, vitamin C, riboflavin, vitamin A. Low amounts when you drink. So the more of these soft drinks you consume, the lower the amount on a daily basis of these nutrients. Six of the seven most popular soft drinks contain caffeine. Even though caffeine, as I have stated previously, increases the excretion of calcium in your urine. And despite these many other health risks, the soft drink industry consistently portrays this product as being possibly healthy. It is not. In 1997, Coca-Cola spent $277 million in advertising targeted groups, including children. The advertising placed their logos and products within easy reach of children. And Pepsi, Dr. Pepper, and 7-Up have licensed their logo to the baby bottler manufacturer Munchin Bottling, Inc., in 1998, Ron Lord wrote in the Agricultural Outlook Forum that sugar had once, quote, had a rather negative public image. Families generally viewed excessive sugar as a health risk and avoided processed sweets. Then in the 1980s, Lord goes on to say, quote, public attention became focused on fat as something to avoid. And about the same time a rather successful advertising campaign to promote the healthy and natural aspects of sugar was conducted. End quote. Now this resulted in an intense increase in carbohydrate, especially sugar consumption. As more sugar found its way into foods not even thought to be sweet, such as fast foods and processed foods, the sugar intake simply was ramped up. Our society is now experiencing the results of the sugar industry's successful advertising campaign to promote, quote, healthy and natural aspects of sugar. There are none. But let's take a look at the negative aspects together. As we'll see, a diet based upon natural foods like vegetables, grains, and legumes is a healthy alternative to this troubling explosion of sugar. Sugar and addiction. Yes, people often say they have a sweet tooth. You may have a friend who excitedly rushes off for a sugar fix, but the links between sugar and addiction are actually well documented in a number of studies. A Dr. Colantuoni, an obesity researcher, showed that excessive sugar intake causes serious dependency and that the removal of sugar creates withdrawal symptoms. He and his colleagues showed that withdrawal from sugar is qualitatively similar to withdrawal from morphine or nicotine. Similar findings concerning sugar's addiction have been published by numerous researchers. Using MRI scanners measuring the brain's reaction to sugar, scientists at the Oregon Research Institute established that sugar has a very similar effect on the brain as highly addictive drugs such as cocaine. Sugar also impacts aging. A particular concern to those researching the andropause and menopause stages of life, sugar's effects on aging should be considered alongside its health risks. Anti-aging research has begun to show that sugar is one of the most powerful aging substances known. One of the most internal negative effects is the bonding between glucose and collagen, called glycation, which can result in many negative effects, including thickening of the arteries, stiff joints, pain, feeble muscles, and failing organs. According to research Dr. L. Melton, diabetics age prematurely because sugar-driven damage of glycation cannot be stopped. Diabetics suffer a very high incidence of nerve, artery, and kidney damage because high blood sugar levels in their bodies markedly accelerate the chemical reactions that form advanced glycation products. According to Dr. Melton, quote, after years of bread, noodles, and cakes, human tissues inevitably become rigid and yellow with pigmented glycation deposits. Researchers have also shown that a lifetime of sugar intake can actually lower your intake of necessary nutrients by suppressing your appetite. Anderson and associate scientists reasoned that a primary mechanism by which carbohydrates are thought to regulate satiety and food intake is through their effect on blood glucose. They found that food intake and subjective appetite are inversely associated. What does that mean in lay language? It means that your blood glucose, your blood sugar response in the 60 minutes following consumption of carbohydrates is going to spike up. That's why candy bars are recommended by advertisers to hold off until you eat a meal. Your body may not be getting any of the nutrients it needs. Why? Because you had something sweet and now you're not hungry when you should have something. But it's being tricked into thinking it's ingested the proper amount of energy. Anderson and his colleagues' study concluded that sugary foods cause appetite suppression and prevent people from achieving a balanced diet with proper nutrients. Now, just imagine how many of us were raised at a time when our mother would tell us, don't eat anything before sugar, it'll spoil your appetite, before dinner. So that is something to consider. They were correct. One of the worst connections is sugar and cancer. In the 1930s, a Dr. Otto Warburg, a Nobel laureate in medicine, discovered that cancer cells have a fundamentally different energy metabolism compared to healthy cells. He found that energy and its increased the sugar intake could increase cancer cell production. So the more sugar, the more cancer. The more primitive nature of cancer cells requires a direct supply of glucose, not being able to master the more complex synthesis of glucose from larger molecules. The buildup of lactic acid and an acidic pH from direct consumption of glucose in cancer cells is a diagnostic factor for cancer. This means that there is a direct relationship between sugar ingestion and the risk of cancer. People with cancer should not be consuming any processed sugars at all. An epidemiological study in 21 countries, mainly in Europe, North America, and Japan, revealed that sugar intake is a strong risk factor that contributes to higher breast cancer rates, particularly in older women. A four-year study in the Netherlands at the National Institutes of Public Health and Environmental Protection compared 111 biliary tract cancer patients with 480 controls. The study concluded the cancer risk associated with the intake of sugars had more than doubled for the cancer patients. Now, these findings are mirrored in the research of Dr. Mashad at the National Cancer Institute, who followed up on two large studies conducted over the last 20 years with 50,000 men and 120,000 women. They concluded that obesity significantly increased the risk of pancreatic cancer and that physical activity appears to decrease the risk of pancreatic cancer, especially among women who are overweight. Preventing obesity by dietary intervention and exercise is by far the best way to avoid pancreatic cancer. But the Mashad team continued their investigation of the triggers of pancreatic cancer and found that evidence from both animal and human studies suggested abnormal glucose metabolism plays an important role in pancreatic carcinogenesis. They investigated whether diets high in sugar were to blame. They found that a diet high in sugar may increase the risk of pancreatic cancer in women who already have an underlying degree of insulin resistance. Well, you're talking about tens of millions of women. There is also the relationship between sugar and cardiovascular disease. A study from the American Heart Association released a report entitled Sugar and Cardiovascular Disease. The report concluded that scientific data indicates that sugar consumption is detrimental to human health, that no data indicates that sugar consumption is advantageous, and that high sugar intake should be avoided. The report also stated that obesity is a definite cause of cardiovascular death and disease. A study from the State University of New York at Buffalo in August 2000 reported that excess sugar in the blood increases the production of free radicals, which have been linked to aging and heart disease. Healthy adults who were given a drink containing 75 grams of pure glucose, that's only about, let's say that's about 3 ounces, the equivalent of 2 cans of cola, that's it, experienced a significant rise in free radicals in the blood 1 hour after drinking the beverage and doubling of free radicals after 2 hours. The sugar drink also produced an increase in a part of an enzyme that promotes free radical generation and a 4% decrease in vitamin E. A Dr. Parrish Dandana concluded, quote, "We believe that in obese people, this cumulatively leads to damage and may cause hardening of the arteries," end quote. Numerous other studies have repeatedly documented the relationship between high blood sugar levels and increased heart disease. In a 2001 UN report commissioned by the World Health Organization and the Food and Agriculture Organization, a team of global experts identified the excessive consumption of sugar from snacks and processed foods and drinks as one of a few major factors causing worldwide increases in cardiovascular disease, cancer, diabetes, and obesity. In 2001, such chronic diseases contributed to 59% of the 59.6 million total reported deaths in the world. That's a tremendous amount of people dying. There's also sugar in children's behavior. Parents often joke about their children being on a sugar high, especially when those children act up or seem to be out of control. But several important studies have actually confirmed the relationship between sugar consumption and behavioral changes in children. Between 1973 and 1977, Dr. William Crook showed that a majority of children could have their behavior affected by the removal of particular foods. This was one of the first studies to confirm a link between diet and behavior. There was also a Dr. Feingold who also came up with similar findings. And then a Dr. Stephen Schollenthaler conducted diet research on children for 30 years. His original seminal studies, eliminating sugar and junk food from the lunch program of 1 million school children in over 800 New York schools during a 7-year period from 1976 to 1983. Learning performance was established first, and then by 1979, diet changes were introduced. High sucrose foods were gradually eliminated or reduced, and there was a gradual elimination of synthetic colors and flavors and selected preservatives like BHT and BHA. There was a 15.7% gain in learning ability compared with other schools during the years in which these changes in diet occurred. Schollenthaler also noted that out of 124,000 children who had at once been unable to learn grammar and mathematics, 75,000 were able to perform these basic tests after dietary changes alone. Nothing else, just that. In other words, removing sugary foods made children smarter. Now, much of this change in learning ability, however, has to do with change behavior in the classroom and during their studies as a result of removing the excess sugar in the diet. And it should be noted that today, sugar intake in children and teens is much higher than it's ever been in American history. A corresponding spike in behavioral problems, dropout rates, and just the inability to learn has been reported by parents and teachers alike. Schollenthaler continued his work by studying thousands of juvenile delinquents on junk food diets. The removal of these sugary foods always resulted in the same end product, an observed dramatic improvement in mood and behavior. With regard to sugar intake in particular, Schollenthaler worked with the Los Angeles Probation Department Diet Behavior Program and observed 1,382 incarcerated delinquents at 3 juvenile detention halls. When trying a low-sugar diet, these young delinquents showed an average of a 44% drop in antisocial behavior, meaning fighting. The greatest reductions, however, were seen in particular groups. Repeat offenders, 86% drop in antisocial behavior. Narcotics offenders, 72%. And so it went. The second part of this study followed 289 juvenile delinquents at 3 juvenile rehabilitation camps. They exhibited a 54% reduction in antisocial behavior after getting rid of the sugar or reducing it. A similar Alabama diet behavior study by Schollenthaler observed 488 incarcerated delinquents for 22 months. The decline in antisocial behavior resulting from reduction in sugar consumption ranged from 17% to 53%, an average of 45%. Well, Schollenthaler's work with juvenile delinquents and sugar intake offers a pretty unflattering evidence of the effects of sugar diet on children's behavior. As we often think about the effect of drug use and abuse on teen delinquency, I believe it's time that we also looked at what happens when sugar is put into the equation. The sugar industry usually cites 4 very small-scale studies to deny any link between sugar consumption and children's behavior. Now, although there are many flaws in those studies, the conclusions are used to suppress any objections to the increased amount of sugar in children's diets. Problems with these studies included a number of issues that weakened their claims. For instance, the amount of sugar used was too small to warrant a reaction. The size of the trial was too small. The observation time was too short, and the control group was denied a nutritious alternative to sugar and artificial sweeteners, which had their own unmeasured effects. They didn't use a true placebo. Now, one of the sugar industry's favorite studies used an average of only 65 grams, which is 13 teaspoons of sugar a day for a trial group of 21 persons. This is the average amount of sugar in a single 10-ounce can of soft drink. A milkshake alone has twice that amount of sugar. One milkshake can have 30 teaspoons of sugar. And a sugar loaded birthday cake can get net 100 teaspoons of sugar in a cake. If one were going to measure the overall effects of too much sugar on children, you'd think a researcher would start at a higher rate. Some researchers have calculated that a growing preteen may consume an average of 50 teaspoons of sugar a day, far more than the meager 13 teaspoons used in the study. A clinical study based upon giving children only 13 teaspoons of sugar, or about 25% of their normal daily consumption of sugar, should not have produced any applicable or appreciable results. Once the study was finished, it hadn't. Yet, by giving the children less sugar than they usually absorbed in a day, the study concluded that the mothers of these children were wrong in saying that their children were hyperactive as a result of the sugar they consumed. Further, in the four central studies often quoted by sugar promoters, the trial size were quite small, using only 10 to 30 children and followed them only for a period of a few hours, not months, weeks or days, hours. In contrast, one of Schollenthauer's studies, 800,000 school children were studied for a long period of time. In six of his other studies, 5,000 juvenile delinquents were studied, and then another 2,000 were studied, sometimes over a year. So the industry, sugar industry, it's a couple hours with a tiny amount and a few people. How stupid do they think we are? It's important to note that the more trustable studies performed by Schoenthaler and Alexander Schaus both showed how diets high in sugar can lead to juvenile delinquency and behavioral problems in children. And their studies were also conducted over a period of several years, not just hours. And for instance, Behar's pro-sugar study gave 21 males their 13 teaspoons of sugar drink and observed them for only 5 hours on three mornings. Well, that doesn't tell us anything. Other criticisms of the pro-sugar studies include that there were usually no controls on the children's normal diets. Thus, the studies were performed with children who were told not to eat any breakfast in the morning. What if you had the children eat a very healthy breakfast and have a very healthy smoothie? And then compare that to the ones that would start their day with a sugar drink or a sugar cereal. It wasn't done. So they would go to school and on an empty stomach. That's not cool. So we can see there is a general consensus among studies championed by the pro-sugar industry. Children's behavior is unaffected by sugar, they say. But there's an opposite consensus among researchers unassociated with the sugar industry and its lobby, and that consensus holds that sugar does have an effect on children, causing behavioral problems that range from hyperactivity to delinquency. Then we have to take a look at the obvious, sugar and dental caries. Studies have repeatedly confirmed that sugar causes dental caries, the cause of tooth decay and cavities. Dr. Scheimham, a professor of epidemiology and public health, found that sugars, particularly sucrose, are the most important dietary cause of dental caries. Both the frequency of consumption and the total amount of sugar are important factors that cause caries. And the evidence establishing sugars as a cause of dental caries is overwhelming, with a foundation in the enormous amount of studies. You can't find any studies that show that sugar is good for your teeth. I can show you a lot of how it causes tooth decay. And it doesn't take a lot. So then we also have to look at your immune system. I've also found numerous quality studies showing that sugar negatively impacts your immune system. And several studies confirm a strong link between high sugar consumption and suppression of the immune system. For instance, in one study, healthy people were assessed for fasting blood glucose levels and phagocytic index of neutrophils, which measures immune cell ability to envelop and destroy invaders such as cancer. Eating 100 grams, that's a little about 24 teaspoons, of carbohydrate from glucose, sucrose, can significantly decrease the capacity of neutrophils to engulf bacteria. And Complex carbohydrates from starch, on the other hand, did not have this effect. And more recently, a doctor, Wybukbanka, found that sugar caused an increase in a protein that inhibits macrophage activity. That also weakens the immune system. And, of course, we know that sugar is related to obesity. Obesity in American children is becoming epidemic. The Journal of the American Medical Association presented a comprehensive national picture of weight trends among children over a 12-year period, and the number of overweight children has just gone through the roof. So there is a relationship between increased sugar consumption and obesity in children and adults, well documented. In fact, the Children's Hospital of Boston and the Harvard School of Public Health conducted the first long-term study to examine the impact of soda and sugar-sweetened beverages on children's body weight. The study involved 548 sixth grader and seventh graders over a 21-month period. During this time, 57% of the children increased their daily intake of soft drinks, and more than half of them by nearly a full serving. The results show that the odds of becoming obese increased by 160%. More recently, Dr. Ludwig, supported by other scientists' work, found that one daily soda increased the risk of obesity by 60%. He found that 65% of adolescent girls and 75% of adolescent boys consume soft drinks daily. And the amount of sugar added to the soft drink is 9 teaspoons a day per soft drink. And then, of course, we have to look at the enormous amount of diabetes that we have. Various anthropological studies have demonstrated that upon the introduction of refined sugar to a culture, the incidence of diabetes increases from a latent period of about 20 years. According to Dr. T. L. Cleave, author of The Saccharine Disease, quote, virtual absence of diabetes in primitive communities who live on complex carbohydrates, such as various grains and tubers, compared with populations eating carbohydrates, which are refined, is anthropological proof that sugar is a leading cause of diabetes. Also, studies demonstrating the undeniable link between sugar consumption and diabetes are well documented. You have Salmerian at the Harvard School of Public Health examining the relationship between glycemic, meaning sugar diets, low-fiber diets, and the risk of non-insulin-dependent diabetes. They found that diets with a high glycemic load and a low cereal fiber content increase the risk of diabetes in women. We also have a reported statistics on the incidence of diabetes, and it's staggering. Just American Diabetes Association shows enormous risk, enormous increase. The Associated Press reported that adult-onset diabetes rose 70% in the previous 8 years among people in their 30s. The Journal of General Internal Medicine estimates that that an additional 16 million Americans have been diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. And so we're getting up there now. Between pre-diabetes and diabetes, we can look about 90 million Americans being affected. And finally, there's the socioeconomic impact. Though it does not directly affect health, it's always good to know the facts behind the product we take for granted. Often when we consider a product we may be ready to do without, finding out that the moral cost of that product actually helps solidify our decision. And as with the moral problems raised by the meat consumption, sugar has its own moral complications. The sugar industry has a long and sordid history of using both slave labor and child labor to harvest sugar, refine it, and bring it to market. In an article appearing October 17, 2001, for Creative Loafing, senior editor John Sugg reported the current exploitation of child labor by the sugar industry. And while we're talking about sugar, you should also take a look at right now, today, in the Dominican Republic, how many people there are working under virtual slave conditions. And they're called sugar plantations, still to this day. So it hasn't gone away. There is an article, The Sugar and Slave Trades, and from the University of Calgary, that provides a productive insight historically on this issue. So from every angle I can see, the scientific literature is filled with proof that sugar on our environment, its production, its destruction of the natural habitat, its exploitation of people, its needing to be subsidized by taxpayers, its consequences to our health, is a negative. Isn't it time that we as a public realized how dangerous this substance is? This was a special in-depth original report, and all of the additional information, including the corporate sponsors of sugar and all scientific references, are on the website progressiveradionetwork.com. And I thank you for listening. I'm Gary Knoll. Let us now say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. Well, here's the factoid of the day. Eric Lawson, the guy who played the Marlboro Man in all the ads, died from, you guessed it, COPD from smoking cigarettes. I just thought I'd throw that out to you. I have something here that I wanted to go over with you, and your audience is consistently emailing me about this. At this time in our economy, middle income is sinking. All of big money is corrupting our democracy. All the economic gains are going to the top. Our Constitution and our Bill of Rights are being shred one by one, one line at a time, while we're sleeping. And it's getting to the point where I know a lot of people in your audience are outraged, and they feel they want to do something, and they're doing things quietly behind the lines. They're getting out of the big banks. They're not shopping in the big box stores. They're growing their own sprouts. And yet, overall, Gary, the general population, there's no outcry. There's no resolution to this. Basically, we should be in a revolution. If you're listening to your words on the air every day and all of the guests and everybody on PRN.
Okay, but who exactly do you expect to engage in any revolt against the government or their corporate interests? First, break it down. You never have people you see in the streets who are the most powerful. With some exceptions, because of social responsibility, some celebrities will lend themselves to social causes, and I commend them for doing that. But more often than not, once you attain a certain celebrity status, depending upon what area you obtain it, you run a risk that if you go to a topic that may alienate your core audience, your sponsors will say no more. You also have to then look at the professional class, those individuals, the professors, lawyers, engineers, architects, who are in the upper middle class. They also would risk their contacts, contracts, and their positions, unless they're tenured, but even tenured professors have been attacked based upon standing up for injustices. Then you have to look at the working class. More often than not, the working class are adaptive, supportive life energies. They're conscientious in what they try to do. They try to be good mothers, good fathers, good brothers and sisters. They like to be good citizens. They're not policy makers, nor are they opinion leaders, nor are they going to be philosophical. But they need someone to believe in. These are the worker bees. They need to know that there's someone speaking on their behalf. So when they're frustrated and they feel that they are impotent by themselves, they will seek someone who will be a voice for them. So Rush Limbaugh, Bill O'Reilly, whoever it is, Ed Schultz, these are the people who become their voices. So now they don't have to change anything or do anything because they have someone who's out there telling them what's wrong and who to vote for and who to vote against. Almost never do they suggest lifestyle changes that could impact them in a positive way. And then you have your working poor. And the working poor are generally working at one or two jobs. They represent over one-third of the American population. They have no political power. They have no major advocates. They don't have people representing them. At one time, the middle class, the working class, had the unions, but the unions have been eviscerated from 51% now down to around 9%, and the right to work laws are being enforced even less. So that which helped us establish a living wage, that which helped establish a standard of living and all the other benefits, that's substantially eroded. So now who's advocating for them? So unless you have leadership, advocates, and immediate attention showing the honest plight of your situation, then you're not going to be the one going to the streets. Otherwise, you would have, if you have 50 people on one block, And if 40 of those people are losing their homes, you would form some association, and then you would try to fight, either get lawyers to try to stop the foreclosures. But there's none of this happening anywhere in America. As a result, you have 9.2 million homes that have been foreclosed on, almost 40 million Americans thrown out on the street. So we are fractured. It doesn't mean that there's not opposition, but within the core of who you're talking about, by those people who believe in the official truth, one reality, there is no other option. They simply have to hope things get better. But the good news is, and why to be optimistic, for about 10% of the American population, or 30 million people, which is formidable, they are the ones who are educating themselves, joining in groups, making proactive commitments to making a better world for themselves, being healthy so they don't have to fall into the healthcare system, being aware by listening to independent voices, not the talking heads of Fox or MSNBC. And those individuals at least are able to get out of harm's way, put energy into being healthy, and understand that their health in reality doesn't come through the official dictates of what they see in the rest of the world. So you've got two scenarios. One group's not going to change. Nothing you or I can do can stop that. And one group is changing in a very dynamic and positive way. And we'll see more of this in the near future. Thanks for your call.
Thanks.
Let's go over and say hello to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Today we're discussing the menu the president will be serving up in his State of the Union address tomorrow night, heaping portions of lame duck.
Well, is that going to be, he should do, what's his name, Boehner, the head of the House?
Boehner, yeah.
Boehner. Of course. He should serve him up beside it. Over to Utrice right now.
I fell asleep late last night, and I dreamed that the night and almost half the day away. I just got up so that I could hear her say,